And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and we have a very special guest today. Our guest is Erin Pitsey, who is maybe known to some of you as the founder of the Modern Women's Shelter Movement, and she's an international author. And most recently, she has become the owner of the WhiteRibbon.org website. Erin was the founder of the Chiswick Women's Aid, the first ever refuge in the world. So, Erin, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm delighted to be back, actually. I remember my interview in 2011 with great affection. and I hope now that you have a huge audience all the way across Australia.
Well, you're certainly doing your bit, Erin, so thank you again for coming on the program once more. Now, looking at your history, you'd expect that you should be feminist royalty, but strangely enough, it doesn't seem to have happened that way. You seem to have drawn more fire from the feminists than just about anybody else.
Well, that happened from the beginning, because when I first started, it was 1971, and I had 4 years when I was running the refuge and taking in the women as they poured through the door with their children. And I could see very clearly that of the first 100 women, because I did a study on it, of the first 100 women that came in, 62 were as violent or more violent than the men they left and were violent to their children. So from my point of view, I was very even-handed. It's not a gender issue. It's never been a gender issue. And I knew that. And my own mother was violent. So that's why I was so open-minded about it all. And what people don't realize, and I keep saying this, is that it was never a women's movement. In 1971, at the beginning of the women's movement, they left me alone. But it wasn't until about 1974 when the women's movement really internationally had run out of steam. It was no longer so very fashionable. And people weren't sending, because in order to join the so-called Women's Liberation, you had to send, in England, £3.10, which is quite a lot of money. It was probably a week's of my housekeeping to join. And then that's the money that they got. As the press died down, so did the money. So what happened then is they could see that by now, the refuge, my refuge, was full of mothers and kids. There was an awful lot of press around it and donations. And I knew they'd come. I knew that eventually they would try and take it over, because if you think about it, the feminist movement itself really didn't have a cause that it could fundraise around. And suddenly here was this idea, we can use the refuge, and we can deem all women as innocent victims of men's violence, and we can have an income. And that's really what happened. They hijacked across the Western world, and it's been a fundraising bonanza for women, which excludes men, all over the Western world, actually. It's now a $1 billion industry.
Yes, there's definitely a strong monetary element to it, because if people looked at the bigger picture, I mean, when you first got involved, the police wouldn't even intervene in these matters because it was a domestic, and there was no welfare available, was there, for women in this situation?
No, there wasn't any. But in a way, the discussion, as I started from the beginning, it's about international domestic violence. So what happens is, when I say international, I mean generational family violence. So if you come from, like I do, from both sides of my family, we have physical violence and abuse. And so what happens is, if the mothers came in who were violent, they needed therapeutic care and intervention to help them learn other strategies for survival. Because if, as a child, you grow up with the rule of the boot and the fist, this is how you learn survival strategies, as I call it. So when the mothers and kids came in, part of the therapeutic community was to learn to use other strategies. So instead of going straight from pain and anger to rage, you learn to express other emotions like sorrow, and you learn that you can trust other people to listen to what you have to say. They're not going to hit you or abuse you.
And your direct experience includes that, I think, when you were younger, you actually regarded yourself as being violent.
Oh, I was an extremely violent child. It's interesting, there were three of us in the family, my twin sister and myself, and my brother, who was about 6 years younger. Now, all three of us experienced, both parents. My father didn't hit us, but he was a terrible bully and a violent, explosively violent temper. But it was my mother who particularly hit me, because I looked like my father, and she claimed from the very beginning that she hated him, but she wouldn't leave him. So we were trapped. At least they chose each other. We didn't have any choice. We were born into a major war that was behind a front door. And, of course, it was behind a very posh front door, because my father was in the Foreign Office. So we had no money problems. There were no housing problems. There was just the fact that both of them came from very dysfunctional families. So there was the chain there. And so when I grew up, my strategy for survival was to fight back. I mean, they couldn't keep me in any school. They didn't know what to do with me, actually. Mm. And I was very violent. I wrote a memoir called Infernal Child, and you can read that story. It's on Amazon. And I was telling the story of what happened. And what saved me was a mentor. A woman called Miss Williams. My parents were sent back to China with my brother and captured by the communists, and they were under house arrest for 3 years, so we didn't see them. But in that time, I'd got to know Miss Williams and to actually respect her and trust her, and that was when I was turned round. So as I based the refuge very much on the concept of teaching children other strategies for survival other than violence, and the mothers, and of course the men. I mean, as soon as I opened the refuge, as soon as I could catch my breath, I realized, of course, men needed refuge. And I was given a house at a peppercorn rent, the other end of London. It was a beautiful house. But my problem was all the men who had the money, who would give me money for women and children, they wouldn't give me a penny for their fellow men. And in the end, the house had to close. But we did start a series of charity shops called Men's Aid. And the idea of that is that we would then use that money particularly to help men. So it's always been both men and women who have been helped. And also, half the staff at Chiswick were always men, because it was so important for mothers and kids to know good, gentle men.
And the current practice is that men and even boys over the age of, say, 12 are not allowed in.
No, they're not. Some little as nine. No, the mothers have to make other arrangements, which is actually shocking, because they're children we're talking about. Yes, but that's, again, the idea being that it's ring-fenced. So to look at the history of it quite simply, it started off in Washington. It was women on the left deciding that they were no longer going to be servants to the men on the left. And they then had a big meeting in Washington, and they declared themselves the Women's Liberation Movement. And instead of capitalism being the enemy, which it had been all along, with men and women fighting capitalism, they changed the goalposts, and the goalposts were called patriarchy. So now the fight was no longer capitalism and its outcome, but it was against all men. And, of course, it's such a ludicrous idea. The fact that it's existed for something like 45 years, I think, is appalling.
Does it extend so that male workers are not permitted in these shelters?
No, they never have been able to. Never.
So there's no exposure to a kind and a gentle man, because they've only experienced their violence.
No, you have to remember the shelters are bunkers where they can brainwash women into paranoia about men. And the tragic part of all this is what it's doing to the women who most need the shelters, and those are the women who are violent. They are the ones who need it. Certainly women, and you can say this about men as well, who are innocent victims, by accident get involved with somebody who's violent. They need support, they need legal help, and they need emotional comfort. But they've come from good, normal homes. They can carry on, given help and some housing, with their lives. But the women that you really need to devote your time to, and the money, is to women and men who are already violent. Because after all, if you're born into a violent family and that's all you know and that's all you learn, it is not terribly surprising then later on you don't know how to make relationships except violent ones.
So we're speaking with Erin Pitsey, who is the founder of the Modern Women's Shelter Movement, and she's got a wealth of stories and a lot of lessons that have been learnt from her experience in working in those shelter movement. We're going to take a short break now. We're going to listen to a song by Tracy Chapman. This song's called Talking About a Revolution.
Don't you know that talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper? Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? It sounds like a whisper while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? It sounds who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's there? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution.
And that was Talking About a Revolution by Tracy Chapman. And we're speaking today to Erin Pitsey, who's the founder of the Modern Women's Shelter Movement. And she has personal experience from setting up that first shelter and a lot of stories, I'm sure. You've promoted the idea very much that violence in this sort of situational family violence has grown from generational change.
It's a view of actually most people who've worked in this field. The evidence has been out now for nearly 10 years, or even longer, particularly Murray Strauss's work. It's always the evidence, and this is proper evidence-based research, shows that men and women are equally violent if they're born into violent relationships. Some, for reasons like, say, me, who are mentored or have other experiences, can do what I call transcend the violence and find other ways of dealing with stress and anger and rage. And that's the work I do, is helping people find other ways of dealing with anger and rage. The most important part of this is it's because the women's movement, women's radical feminists, very early on ended up doing all the teaching, all the agencies. So they were teaching the judiciary, the police, the family agencies, their particular brand of radical feminism, which blames all men. So the entire thing was skewed by these women who basically preach hatred against half the human race. So that almost overnight, men were losing hopelessly in the courts. Social workers were against the fathers because they were trained to think of them as perpetrators. Perpetrator programs, particularly the Duluth model, which is the only model that is actually funded here in this country, essentially starts with on the premise that the man is guilty, and even if there's absolutely no evidence against him, which is true of most cases, they are still put through perpetrator programs, where they have to, among other things, apologize for their male privilege.
When someone like yourself raises a voice in protest and argues for common sense and for decency and for people being treated fairly, the world comes down on you. So it sounds to me very much like feminism is a form of tyranny.
Yes, it has. It's very close. It's, in a sense, its own fascist organization. But behind it, you have to remember that it actually isn't about human beings. It's not about wanting to help anybody. It's actually a money project. And it is a billion-dollar industry. And in the very early days, a lot of women professors couldn't get tenure. And quite rightly, they were angry about this. But of course, the concept then of creating women's studies in universities across the Western world actually ring-fenced again the professors' tenures, and they could only be women. And for a very long time, men were not welcome in any of the lectures. They were for women only. And if a man did try and get in, the hostility would soon move him out. Well, as you know now, after sort of probably a couple of generations of men now going to university, the figures are dropping because they've made it such a hostile place for young men to come and learn. And also they have created this hysteria about rape on campuses. And none of it actually stands up, because if you look at all the figures, young women are a great deal safer on campuses than they ever are in the external world.
Yes, we used to think of universities as being a bastion of free speech, but I think you've found it otherwise.
No, that's all gone. No. Along with any fascist movement comes the curtailing of speech. One of the first things that get lost are the free speech. Mm. And then the second thing that happens is that anybody who wants to argue against them, especially in the media, because it's mostly run, anything to do with women's issues is largely run by feminist journalists and reporters, you won't get anything published. Where the great strength is on the internet. And, for instance, the other day I did a, I don't know if you heard it, I did an interview with Sargon of Akehead. And over 60,000 people have looked at that interview. So it shows you how desperate people are to hear the truth.
You're very welcome on this program. We value free speech on Dads on the Air, and we feel very privileged to have you, Aaron Pitsey, on the program once again. I'm very interested, I hope we could get onto this, how you happen to come into ownership of the whiteribbon.org website, because that's really another feminist stronghold, or one would expect.
Have you had a chance to look at my website?
I have.
Good, because there you will find all sorts of evidence-based research that backs everything I'm saying. And yes, what happened is it came up, it was offered, actually, to someone who I knew. He wasn't able to take it on. So I heard about it, and I said, I'll take it on. Let me have it. Because I realized that the other white ribbon organizations were, to their utter shame, men who were willing to raise money to use against other men. And the money that's raised anyway, I think if you look on the online at the Voice for Men, you'll see there was a big study done on what happened to the money for all these other white ribbons. Well, the money, I promise you, does not go to refuges or shelters for desperate women and children. So I think anybody thinking of donating should have a very good look at the evidence before they donate.
Yes, whiteribbon.org would be such a valuable site, I would think, but it's now in friendly hands, I would say. It's you give something to a busy person, don't they? So you've taken on yet another big project.
Well, it's an exciting project, and this week I'm writing an article on the subject of men going their own way, MGTOW, which I think is a very healthy movement, and many of the men who call themselves MGTOWs don't consider a movement necessary. It's a private decision that a lot of men make, which in a funny, it's a sort of unintended consequence, really, because what's happened is that as men have woken up to the fact that they have been treated like enemies, they have been savagely barred from seeing their children in many cases. Many of them suffer from the most dreadful allegations against them, and they're made homeless. Younger men, largely, and the men who've been badly burnt, are looking at it and thinking, I don't need to be part of this circus. I don't need to be one of those monkeys. I can get on with my life very happily and not ever risk what it means, because they're saying, and they're right, any sensible person would agree, if you look at marrying a woman or even living with a woman for a period of time, you risk the fact that she will get the house or a flat. She can, just by picking up the phone, have you arrested. She can then make any allegations she likes. You are guilty until you prove your innocence. So the man's lost his human rights. And in the case I'm dealing with here, completely innocent man, going home on a big tube station, buys a ticket, goes home, next morning, four policemen on his doorstep, tell him that he's been accused of woman on the platform. He has no idea who she is. He has no idea of anything. He is suddenly charged and taken down to the police station and let out on bail. And this has been hanging over his head now for nearly a year. There will be a trial, and it's Kafka, really. He doesn't have any idea of how this could happen to him. Because, again, men have lost their human rights. All women in this country, I don't know if it's the same in Australia, all women have to be believed. It doesn't matter what they say. And once you put that out as a dictate for everybody, that means all men, by definition, are guilty until they're proven innocent.
We had the police commissioner for Victoria on national television saying that when women came and made an allegation, they must be believed. So it's a very similar thing.
But isn't that tragic? It's against everything and all the human rights articles. You have a right to a fair trial. Men do no longer have a right to fair trial.
The other problem is that when people are labelled as such, if all men are rapists, then that message gets out. Well, then young boys are going to think, oh, I'm going to be a man, I'm going to be a rapist. I mean, it just sort of follows, doesn't it?
Well, in a sense, for a young man now to go to university, he is treated like a potential rapist and he has to attend lectures to explain to him how not to be a rapist. Mm. So do you think many young men are going to be willing to go to university under those circumstances?
No, I don't think so. This is such a big topic, and it's so great that you're out there still fighting, Erin, and fighting the good fight. We can only hope that it leads to something in our lifetime. But we've come to the end of the program. I just wanted to ask you if you'd like to pick a song for us to go out on and tell us why you picked the song.
Well, there's that lovely man whose name I keep forgetting, who died not that long ago, and he was singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and that when my mother had very bad cancer, and even though she hated me all her life, when she was dying, she made amends, and I used to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow to her.
Oh, that's a lovely story. Well, this is Somewhere Over the Rainbow by Israel Kamakawiwa Ole from Hawaii.
Okay, this one's for Gabby. Myself. What a wonderful world. Well, I see skies of blue and I see clouds of white and the brightness of day. I like the dark and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people passing by. I see friends shaking and singing, how do you do? They really sing, I love you. I hear babies cry and I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than we'll know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That was Somewhere Over the Rainbow by Israel Kamakawiwo Ole, the special selection by our guest today, Aaron Pitsey. So it remains for me to thank you very much, Aaron, for being on the program today.
It's always a pleasure to be with Dads on Air.
Thank you, and we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. If you go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, you can send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. And for now, this is Bill Cable signing off, and we'll be back again next week with another show.